KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next in this morning's opening forum hour, a new report is out, issued just this morning, on the gender divide in colleges and universities. There are more women in higher education, and women are doing better than men. What does it mean, and how should colleges and universities respond? We'll have a panel in an hour, which will include your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. In 2000, there was a report on gender equity in education released by the Center for Policy Analysis. With much additional information, a new report officially released just this morning points to a gender gap in academic achievement. Over the past quarter of a century, women have been the majority on college and university campuses across the United States. Presently, men represent about 42% of the nation's college students, though in higher-income families, men under the age of 24 attend college as much or slightly more than women. Except for engineering, women are now also in the majority in graduate and professional schools, and women graduate with more honor degrees than their male counterparts, who in numbers are much more apt to be on probation or to have disciplinary problems. A couple of national studies point out that men overall study less and socialize more than women, and so not surprisingly, in light of such facts, women are more apt to graduate. So what does all of this apparent new gender divide bode for the colleges and universities? Well, we're going to examine the statistics and what has come out of these recent studies and find out what they all point to with a panel this morning. And let me introduce to you first Jacqueline King, who is director of the American Council on Education Center for Policy Analysis. She co-authored the report, which is titled Gender Equity in Higher Education, and joins us from the nation's capital. Welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Sarah Mead, a senior policy analyst for Education Sector. That's a nonprofit education think tank. She wrote a report for Education Sector on male and female performance in grade school and in higher education. Welcome, Sarah Mead.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Linda Sachs, associate professor in the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies at UCLA, joining us from Los Angeles this morning. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you, and it is good morning. It's good afternoon back in Washington, but good morning for us, Linda Sachs. Jacqueline King, let me begin with you. This gender divide or gender gap or whatever we want to call it is pretty small, as your report points out, compared to, say, the ongoing income gap or racial gap. So how seriously are we to take these numbers?
I think that the numbers point to important differences for certain groups, especially low-income men and minority men, especially blacks and Hispanics. I don't think that we need to get too worried about a widespread, universal problem with enrollment in college for all men. But there are certain groups who clearly they are falling behind their female peers in terms of their participation in higher education.
And different reasons that one can speculate as to why this is the case?
There's a lot of speculation, and unfortunately, most of it is just that. There's very little hard research on why this is happening, but there are no shortage of theories.
There is also some questions for the institutions to ask on this whole gender issue, and what kind of questions, perhaps, do you think are most prominent?
We did this report really for colleges and universities to help them think about this issue, and one of the first questions is, which groups of men are enrolling? It's not very helpful to know that you have a majority of women without understanding why that's happening, which groups of men are not enrolling at the same rate as women, and then institutions can hopefully tailor some of their outreach activities to try to engage those groups of young men.
Does that mean in some instances seeking balance in whatever way that's possible?
Different schools are approaching this in very different ways. There are, have been a small number of schools that have been outspoken that they are seeking a balance. Dickinson College in Pennsylvania clearly is one of them that's been most public about that. For most institutions, they're not aggressively trying to seek a balance through any kind of affirmative action. But many are trying to target some of their outreach activities in the high schools to try to engage young men who at the moment are not as likely to participate in those kinds of programs.
And your data comes almost exclusively from government data, right?
Yes, we were looking at sort of the big long-term trends nationally using government databases.
This also, by the way, we should mention, I mean, in addition to some of the things I mentioned at the top, the discovery here is that males are more apt to be suspended or expelled and more apt to have learning disabilities and emotional problems. I mean, all of these kinds of things factor in as well.
We didn't look at that. There has been certainly some work on that in the K-12 world in terms of students being assigned to special education or having disciplinary issues. There's much less information in that regard at the higher education level.
Again, Jacqueline King is director of the American Council on Education Center for Policy Analysis and co-authored the report, Gender Equity in Higher Education. I'm going to go to Sarah Mead now because she's been working with not only higher education, but down in grade school and so forth. Carol Gilligan and others were telling us that we had to be mindful of girls in crisis. Is this kind of a sea change we're seeing here, Sarah Mead?
I don't think it's a sea change. I think that the focus of what they were talking about is very different from some of the concerns that people are talking about now related to boys in terms of academic achievement and focus on college enrollment and factors like that, as well as things like disabilities and suspensions and expulsions. And I think also the nature of the groups of boys that we're concerned about now are a little bit different than the groups of girls that that were really the focus of some of the concern 10 or 12, 20 years ago.
Boys do have more problems, though, as I was indicating. I mean, they tend to drop out more. They tend to go to jail or commit suicide more. I mean, just in higher numbers, right?
Boys are more likely to experience a lot of the problems that you're talking about. They are more likely to have disciplinary problems, suspensions, expulsions. They tend to have higher rates of drug and alcohol abuse. They're also much more likely than girls to be diagnosed with various disabilities that impact on their education. About two-thirds of the youngsters that are diagnosed with disabilities are boys. And for some diagnoses like autism and emotional disturbance, about 80% are boys.
Let's look at, if we could, some of the gender divide statistics that your research has led to. I mean, first of all, an overall decline in both genders in reading.
Only at the high school level.
At the high school level, right.
Yeah.
But
I mean,
in the elementary level, it's better, in fact, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's actually a trend that we see across a whole bunch of different subjects, and really for both genders. In the National Assessment of Educational Progress, as we see improvement with the elementary school-aged children, particularly in math, but also in reading. And then we see sort of stagnation a lot of times at the middle school level with some small improvements. And then we're really seeing some sort of disheartening results on the NAEP for high school students in terms of stagnant or a lot of times declining results.
In high school, generally?
Yes.
Across the board. But boys are doing better on SATs and national assessments, particularly in math and science, than girls?
Well, boys have really almost always scored better than girls on both sections of the SAT, but that's the conversation there is a little strange because that's largely due to self-selection in terms of who takes the SAT. Girls are much more likely than boys to take the SAT, so there's a larger pool of girls taking the SAT that tends to incorporate more lower-performing girls or girls from subgroups that are less likely to do well on the test. So it really talking about that comparison isn't fair to boys or girls. In terms of some of the national assessment data that isn't self-selected, the National Assessment for Educational Progress, also a lot of the assessments used by states for their accountability systems, boys tend to do slightly better on math, slightly better on science, and significantly better in geography than girls.
But girls better in reading and writing.
Girls better in reading and writing. And the gaps that favor girls in reading and writing tend to be larger than the gaps favoring boys in math and science.
So we need more research. What does that mean? That we need for what, to find evidence for what specifically?
Sure. Well, I think that there's two things. One is that if we're concerned about these areas where some of the gaps are growing, particularly college enrollment where women seem to be pulling ahead of men. We really need more research to understand why that's happening, because there's such a tangled array of things that influence that. I mean, there's economic incentives, there's educational preparation issues. I mean, we know that, for example, in a state like California, where students, you know, need to complete a certain curriculum to be eligible for admission to the state universities, there girls are more likely than boys to complete that curriculum. But you know, there's also possibly social and cultural issues that we really don't, you know, have a lot of good research to understand what's going on.
I was going to ask you about that, because women seem, especially in the college level, from the study that Jacqueline King's group did, seem to work harder and get better GPAs, and it may have to do, to some extent, with guys not thinking it's cool to study.
Sure. I mean, that's one of the things that I think it would be really interesting to see some good research on. We read all these anecdotes about it in, you know, different magazines and newspaper articles, but I haven't seen any, you know, really solid research looking at what do boys think about the culture, you know, what's manly in the culture and things like that. And I think that would be sort of interesting research for someone to do.
Sarah Mead, again, is Senior Policy Analyst for Education Sector and wrote a report for Education Sector on male and female performance in grade school and higher education. Linda Sachs is Associate Professor in the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies at UCLA and did a study that, actually a survey of 17,000 students at four-year colleges over a four-year period and came up with all kinds of interesting data, actually. To begin with, Linda, we can say pretty safely that the women study more than men, and they do better, I mean, generally, now in colleges.
Yeah, all of the gender gaps that we've seen in terms of time spent devoted to studying and meeting with professors or meeting with teachers, all of the sort of gaps that we see at the K-12 level persist in the higher education and in many cases become wider. So, you know, the gap in terms of high school grades, for example, tends to become a little bit wider during college. And it's not just due to the fact that women do spend more time studying. Gaps in achievement persist even when we account for study time and other factors.
Also, I discovered from your research, women have more favorable results from their interaction with faculty.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting. I mean, this is not to sort of disclaim or discount the chilly climate research that has documented some negative experiences for women in college classrooms, but by and large, women in college tend to report more favorable interactions with their professors than male students do. They feel a greater level of support from their faculty. They actually interact with faculty more often. Now, who initiates that interaction, we don't know from our data, but definitely a higher level of satisfaction with their faculty than the men report, although women tend to report higher levels of satisfaction with pretty much any outcome of college.
Although more negative feedback produces more of an effect on women, you discovered, right?
Right. So it's one thing to look at the level of interaction and satisfaction and feedback, and then the other question, which is what I'm looking at in a book I'm in the middle of writing, is this issue of how do these interactions impact women and men perhaps differently. And that's where I have found some pretty interesting results, in that the nature of the faculty interaction does produce different sort of effects on women and men. So for example, for women, having certain sort of negative experiences with faculty, feeling that faculty didn't take them seriously in the classroom, for example, relates to declines in women's physical health, which I find sort of interesting. So declines in their physical sense of well-being, their math confidence, their aspirations for graduate degrees, these sort of declines in a sense of academic confidence and physical and emotional well-being are not observed for the men who experience some negative interactions with faculty. So there is some sort of difference in that regard. We also find faculty to have a different impact on women's and men's perspectives on gender roles in society. So one very interesting finding is that for the students who interact with faculty in a research basis, so they get some really good, perhaps good, but at least one-on-one individual attention in the research lab, that for men, that actually tends to promote a sort of egalitarian viewpoint about women. But for women, those sorts of research interactions tend to lead to a belief that the best opportunities and the best result for married women is to be confined.
I'm sorry, I missed the last part of your sentence there.
Oh, that working with faculty and research tends to lead women more likely than men to believe that the activities of married women should be confined to the home and family. So some very different results of the same sort of interactions.
Different results from faculty interaction with women students where social activism is concerned, too?
Right. So that's another interesting pattern of effects. In general, when students interact with faculty, it tends to promote a sense of social activism and often a liberal political orientation. But these effects were significantly stronger among the men. So it sort of raises the question of what is the nature of faculty interaction with male students and with female students, and given the fact that the vast majority of college faculty are men still at this point, that it may be a function of men interacting with male faculty. Now, the problem with this is that despite my 17,000 students, I don't know the gender of the faculty they're interacting with. So that's something that we truly need to explore in other research.
But did you look at all women's schools and see the kind of differences that exist?
Right. Well, this particular study is focused on the experience of men and women in the same 200 institutions. So therefore, I don't have single-sex colleges in this study. Although I will say that one thing that sort of speaks to this is that attending colleges with greater proportions of female faculty tends not to have so much of an impact on the female students, but has a tremendous, that's perhaps overstating it, but does have an effect on men's outcomes. For whatever reason, having more female faculty relates to gains in confidence for the male students, academic confidence, social confidence, that are not witnessed among the female students.
I found also some of your data illuminating in terms of the way leisure is used by male versus female students. Can you sort of run that down for us? Give us
So again, there's this issue of level and then impact. And with respect to level, we've for a long time in the survey found significant gender differences in how students spend their time. So for example, women tend to spend more time on what I call responsibility-centered activities. So we're talking about studying, working on clubs and groups, volunteer work, helping out with their families. Women tend to spend more time than men on those activities, but men spend consistently and significantly more time than women watching television, playing video games, partying, exercising. So it's no wonder that we find consistent and significant gender differences in student stress, because the men tend to engage in activities that are a form of stress release. Now,
excuse me, they're more likely to cut classes as well as not do their homework.
That's sort of interesting, because cutting classes might be perceived as sort of a non-stressful sort of, you know, relaxed attitude, but for a lot of students, that actually ultimately leads to greater stress overall, because they've now missed class and they may have finals coming up. But in terms of the impact of some of these recreation and leisure activities, one very interesting finding was the role of sports and exercise. For the women, those who spent more hours per week exercising and being involved in sports or intercollegiate athletics, they tended to get better grades in college than the women who spent less time on sports and exercise. For the men, however, there was an opposite effect, so that for the men, the more time they spent on exercise and sports, the lower their grades were.
There's also a gender divide that came out of your research, talking to some 17,000 students at four-year colleges about women needing more to establish independence from their families.
Right. This is something that I have found in research looking at students within the first year of college, as well as over 4 years. So there seems to be something here that suggests that it is seemingly more important for women to establish a sense of independence from their families than it is for men. So, for example, the farther that they go from home, so the distance from their home to their college, is particularly important establishing a sense of confidence in a woman's academic abilities, their leadership abilities, and even their emotional well-being, which for men, this doesn't seem to have an impact. For women, staying in close communication with families, such as through email or phone calls, is helpful to a point, but at fairly high levels tends to inhibit their sense of independence and development in college in a way that doesn't seem to impact the men.
Linda Sachs, again, is associate professor in the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies at UCLA. Jacqueline King, again with us from Washington, directs the American Council on Education's Center for Policy Analysis and was co-author of this report. You had said before, Jacqueline King, that this leads to a lot of speculation in terms of the effects and what the causes are behind them. But one has to ask sort of generally how much this can be tracked in terms of just changes with the so-called women's liberation movement or with more equity where sexual politics is concerned.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look back historically, certainly you see women's participation in higher education started to really take off during the 1970s, and the women's movement had a big impact on that. What we're seeing now, of course, is that this is not just a phenomenon for middle and upper income young women. Those women are now attending college in very high numbers. But we're also seeing increased enrollment among low-income women and women of color. And there, the women's impact movement may have some impact, but probably even more important is the nature of the economy. It's just not possible these days for women with no post-secondary education to make a living that would sustain a family. And I think girls and young women recognize that and are acting accordingly by taking advantage of post-secondary education, whether it be a four-year institution or, in many cases, a community college or a short-term vocational program. Young women are recognizing that you just can't make it nowadays without some level of post-secondary education. For young men coming from low-income backgrounds, they may still have the impression that they can earn a decent living in fields that don't require a college education. And at least when you get right out of high school, that may be true. You may feel that that job, you know, driving a van, delivery van, or working in a warehouse pays reasonably well. You may find as you get older and your back isn't as strong that wasn't the greatest choice. But I think girls see a very stark choice coming out of high school that maybe isn't as clear for young men.
There was an article in the Amherst Times about this gender divide that I happened to read, and a lot of this, of course, is anecdotal, but it gave a picture that generally suggested, I mean, stereotypes notwithstanding, talked about boys who were slackers and girls who were fireballs, men and women, I should say. But there's generally perceived, at least I perceive from this, stronger motivation across the board where women are concerned. Is that fair to say, Jacqueline King? Yeah.
You know, this is one of those areas where we really need some solid research, because what we have to go on right now in general is anecdotal evidence. Linda's work has pointed to this a bit, but right now it's sort of an open season for folks with various pet theories to suggest what may or may not be happening, because we really don't have a lot of hard research.
Well, I'm going to open up our phone lines and invite our listeners to weigh in on this. And, in fact, you're cordially invited to join us now, whether you're listening to us on radio, Internet, or Sirius Satellite. We welcome your phone calls, and you can call us now toll-free at 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free, and the lines are open and available to you at 866-733-6786. If you have something you'd like to say on the subject of the gender divide in academic achievement at the college level, or if you have a question or comment for any of our guests, who include Jacqueline King again, as well as Sarah Mead and Linda Sachs, you can also email any thoughts or questions or comments you have to us, and we welcome your emails as well. Our email address here is forum, F-O-R-U-M, at kqed.org. Like to hear from you what your observations are on this topic, and we'll return, in fact, with your calls and emails shortly after this. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the gender divide and academic achievement at the college and university level. Talking about a report. In fact, it was just released officially this morning by the Council on Education Center for Policy Analysis. And with us is Jacqueline King, who is the co-author of that report, Sarah Mead, who is a senior policy analyst with Education Sector, and Linda Sachs, who is associate professor in the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies at UCLA. And let me go right to your calls, and let's begin with Ben. Morning.
Good morning.
Yes, hi, Ben. You're on.
Yes, I'd like to know where I can get the research that was quoted this morning. I'm a teacher, and I work a lot with students on their academic achievement.
The research from the Gender Equity in Higher Education or Linda Sachs's research?
Both.
Okay. Jacqueline King, can they go to your website and get...
They sure can. The American Council on Education's website has the report available.
Okay.
And Linda Sachs, your data?
The specific information about teaching, so the impact of faculty on men and women,
right,
is in an article published in, and I'm sorry, I don't have the issue number, but an issue of the Journal of College Student Development within the past year.
College Student Development.
And okay. Sarah Mead, what about your research?
Sure, it's available on the Education Sector website.
And that is?
www.educationsector.org.
One word.
Yep.
Okay. Ben, thank you for the call.
And thank you.
We'll go to more of your calls, and let's go to Michelle. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I'm actually calling because there's a book that I read called Why Gender Matters, and I don't have the author name at hand. But it goes into genetic differences of girls and boys. It goes from pretty much elementary through actually high school, but it just goes on the genetic differences and, you know, how their brains are structured differently, they hear differently, they see differently. And I was wondering, and then it's actually for parents and teachers to understand how children, girls and boys function differently and learn differently.
Well, we get into, with this kind of topic, we always get into nature and nurture, and I don't think any of our guests are scientists, but I don't know if any of you want to speculate on just how much that figures into all this calculus. Sarah Mead?
Sure. I've looked into a lot of the work, such as you're referring to. I think that's a book by Leonard Sachs.
No relation, by the way.
Excuse me?
Is it no relation to Linda Sachs?
No. No. About those issues, and there is a lot of work on this. It's very popular. I think there's a couple things that are important to keep in mind. One is that a lot of this research is relatively new. A lot of what we're looking at when we look at some of these brain research findings are things like, the size of different physical structures in the brain, blood flow to different areas of the brain, and even though we identify this stuff and it's very interesting, it may be connected, it's tantalizing to think it could be connected to phenomenon that we observe in day-to-day behavior and activities of people, doing causal work along those lines is really difficult. And, drawing those kind of causal connections that these things are connected because this is, created by biology or hormones or genes in the brain is a difficult thing. And I think that when you read some of the work of the people who are actually doing, these MRI scans and the really cutting-edge brain research, you see a lot of caution in what they're doing, but also a lot of excitement about the long-term potential, and I think down the road, 10 years or so, answering some of these questions will really be helped by this. I think the other thing that's really important to keep in mind, though, when we're talking about these brain differences is that a lot of these brain differences that we identify, sort of average differences between the sexes in either cognitive abilities or brain structure and function are just that, average differences. And when you look at the variation within men or the variation within women, you'll find much bigger variation than the average difference between the two. And so it's very important to realize that when you're talking about an individual child, that information about average differences may be utterly useless.
Well, it's always been a fact that males have larger brains, but girls are doing better, females are doing better, right?
Well, men do have about 11% larger brains, but in terms of intelligence research, all the intelligence research finds the same average intelligence for men and women.
Yeah, so size doesn't matter, at least in this case. And let me thank Michelle for her call and go to more of your calls here. Next caller is Michael. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for a great topic this morning. Just one comment and then a question. I'm actually on the local Burlingame School Board, and we just had staff do a study on, how can we bring the middle school underachievers, bring them up. We still haven't figured out how to do that, but one interesting point was about two-thirds of those students at the lower end that are failing are boys. And then I guess the play into there is what can we do more at the elementary level, which in my mind is where we need to address this problem, and personally I believe college is too late trying to figure out the differences there. And so that's the question, is what can we do at the elementary level to work on this gender gap, And then the other question I have is, I have read some of the articles that have come out this week on this topic, and why are we promoting, or why are some colleges promoting, like, bringing football into the programs to attract more men when the studies are showing that actually men participating in sports doesn't help their academics?
Well, let me go first. Two good questions. Sarah Mead, let's talk about maybe recommendations you might have from your research and your expertise in this field that might carry over into the elementary level.
Sure. I think the elementary level is interesting both because that's where we're seeing boys making the greatest gains nationally. I know that's not true in every sort of individual school or situation, but nationally that's where we're seeing the greatest gains for boys. But it's also the area where I think we have the clearest evidence that there are organic things going on that may be causing some differences between boys and girls' achievement. There are some developmental reasons that, you know, at age 5, age 6, girls will be ahead of boys verbally. And so, you know, as we're talking about reading curriculum, which has been such a huge focus of, you know, elementary school reform in the past, you know, 10, 15 years, those things in some ways tend to matter more for boys. Boys suffer more if they don't get a good reading curriculum because they start out developmentally not in the same place that girls are when they're, you know, 5 and 6 years old. Their verbal development is just a little slower when they're young.
Linda Sachs, the caller, also brought up football. Now, I imagine that boys are more fans of football. It's not a question of even playing football. It's also of attracting them because you have, say, a football team at a college or university. Although after Title IV, there were more teams dropped from different colleges. Title IX, there were more teams dropped at colleges and universities. But I would imagine some of your leisure studies showed just generally that this would be a magnet to some extent, wouldn't it?
Well, it might be for some men. I think that's a bit short-sighted to focus on football and athletics as the key recruitment tool for men. I think the bigger issue is not to jump to some of these solutions as an answer to the gap that we're seeing, but to do systematic studies that look at, well, what is the impact of having greater proportions of women on a college campus? What impact does that have? Is there a tipping point at which point there are perhaps too many women? We don't actually know that.
But makes it tougher for dating, doesn't it?
Yeah, right. There just seems to be an assumption that once we go, you know, once the split becomes larger than 50-50 or maybe 55-45, that we inevitably have major problems facing the women and the men. And we don't necessarily know that. In fact, the research that I've done has looked at sort of a crude measure of the gender composition of the campus and has shown positive impact of having of the gender composition in terms of the proportion of women having a positive impact on both men and women. And the question is, well, is it really that as we increase the number of women that it's an overall more positive campus environment? Well, probably not. There's probably some tipping point. That's the kind of research that needs to be done before we jump to the sort of solutions that aren't really tested out in the research.
The other piece of this is to understand who are the men who aren't coming. If what you found is, which if you find that what's really happening is you've got big female majorities among your older students who attend, say, at night or on the weekend, well, a football program isn't going to make any difference to those students. They're coming to upgrade their skills in the workforce. So the other piece of this is for campuses to really understand who their student population is and where they have these gender imbalances. It may be among the traditional age students, and maybe they'll be attracted by a football team, but it may be among other groups.
Let me go to more calls, and we welcome a caller from Witherville, Virginia. Do I have the name right, Elisa?
Yes. I basically have a comment and then a question. What you guys were talking about earlier really resonated with me due to the fact that my husband went to a trade school and thought that he was going to be doing great. And just as you said, he now realizes that your back and hands do wear out and most people don't make it in his field until the age of 45. So whereas I went to community college and am now doing well and, you know, feel like long-term I will be doing better. Now, my real question is, how do we handle a child, we have a son, what can we do to prepare him for college and secondary education when every male in his family has attended some type of trade or does some type of skill work?
How to get students interested in college, male students, I guess, Jacqueline King, that's kind of in your terrain, isn't it?
I would say two things. I would say exposing your son through friends, extended family, anyone you can find who can be a mentor who did go to college to see how those people work every day. And then I think having them spend some summers when they're in high school doing really grungy, hot, sweaty work can make a big impression on a kid that working outside with your hands may not always be all it's cracked up to be. It can be wonderful for some people and a great career choice, but there's something to be said for some of the jobs that come with a college degree that involve sitting in a chair in air conditioning, too.
Yeah, but again, I think it has to be footnoted here that there are a lot of young people who feel, particularly in the liberal arts fields, that they're not necessarily going to have a passport or a ticket to a job.
Well, we do find that the unemployment rate for people with a bachelor's degree is much lower than the unemployment rate for others. And although students who may major in the liberal arts may not see that absolutely clear career trajectory after college, they do find that those soft skills, many employers talk about wanting the soft skills, which means communication skills, the ability to write, ability to speak, ability to work well in teams on projects, that those skills are very important. And so while there may not be that crystal clear career trajectory coming out of college with a degree in a field like English, many students find that the skills they learn in college, once they do figure out the field they want to be in, that those skills serve them well, and serve them well as they change careers, because we know most people do end up having more than one career over their lifetime.
Incidentally, if you've just joined us, we're talking about the gender divide in academic achievement at the college and university level. Your calls are welcome at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or by email, and the email address here is forum@kqed.org. I'm going to go to a couple of the emails here. This is from Diane, who says, I find it perplexing that women's increasing academic achievement over the past 20 years has not significantly narrowed the gender wage gap in the workplace. It appears that the workplace measures and rewards different from our education system. Does our education system need to align itself better with the workplace? Well, what do you think, Jacqueline King?
Well, I guess I'd rather see the workplace align itself more with education and reward women for the achievements that they're making. Certainly, that the listener is correct that the wage gap has not narrowed to the level that one might expect when one looks at the educational attainment levels that women are achieving. That's going to be something that I think we'll all continue to watch. Of course, there are extenuating circumstances. Women are more likely to take time out of the workforce for family rearing and that sort of thing. But even when you control for all of that, you still see a gender gap in terms of wages that favors men.
Let me read another email here from a listener named Erin, who writes, I'm a 34-year-old woman, single, childless, with a college degree. My experience is that even when men opt for secondary education, very few of them actually think about the fact that they will need to support a family and have plans or even backup plans taking such a desire into account. As someone who majored in feminism, it is disturbing to me to realize that its side effect of more women in the workplace seems to have been interpreted by many men as a release from the responsibility of realistic life planning, to the point of barely even being able to support themselves, much less a child. It seems they take advantage of the fact that the mother will always be present. Women, on the other hand, are raised to know that should they have children, there is a distinct possibility that they may wind up supporting any children they may have by themselves, and this information appears to show that women are planning accordingly. You see a gap there as well, Jacqueline King?
I haven't looked at that kind of information about sort of the expectations of men with regard to family formation. I don't know if Linda has.
Well, I was going to ask Linda Sachs. Let's go to you, Linda Sachs.
Well, you know, the issue here is that I have looked at this, but what I'm looking at in my samples are women and men who do go to college. So it doesn't exactly address the issue of the man who chooses not to go to college. But certainly among those who go to college, we do see the women to be more focused on the financial outcomes of college, not so much the long-term accumulation of wealth, because that is something that tends to be more of an interest among the men who go to college, but for the women, there's a concern about paying for college, both during college and then being able to pay back loans after. And this is significant because, you know, Jacqueline King has already talked about the fact that we now have greater numbers of low-income women coming to college. Well, that means that when we're talking about the college-going population, there are significant gender differences in the level of financial concern and the ability to pay for college. So that when we think about students, we need to remember that female students have financial concerns during college, are more likely to anticipate employment during college than the men are. So it's a very different sort of population. But in terms of beyond college, both men and women are concerned about having enough money to pay for college. It's just that the concern is much greater among the women when they're in college.
And we go to more calls from Nashville. Jonathan, join us. Hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Hi there.
I first have a comment and then a question. My comment being that I am newly graduated from college about 3 years ago. And personally, I found that the men that, at least in my circle, tend to just sort of do what they can to slip by, and the women seem to try a whole lot harder at what they're trying to accomplish. And my question is, at what point did society judge people on their degrees, you know, like if you went to college or not? Like, all that information can be learned. You don't have to go to college to learn that information, you know. So at what point did people say, okay, let's hire only people that have gone to college, not the people who have maybe learned this on their own or through other experiences?
Boy, you're asking for a cultural historian analysis here, I think, Jonathan. Tough question, because the whole notion of a college degree, I mean, it's tied to the GI Bill and the allowances of men going to college and getting a degree. And it really dates back, I think, quite a ways, earlier this century, the idea that if you had a college education, you could definitely advance, and then statistics bore that out. Anybody want to comment here on our panel?
Well, we've been seeing what economists call the premium on a college degree, the amount that you can earn over what you might have earned with a high school diploma. That's been rising steadily. It dipped for a brief period after the Vietnam War, during the really high inflation periods of the late 1970s and early 80s. We also at that point had sort of a glut of college-educated men in the workforce because, quite frankly, many men chose college as a way to avoid the draft for the Vietnam War. But since then, since that period, you've seen a steady increase in the premium on a college degree for both men and women, although, of course, at different levels, with men earning, on average, quite a bit more. So while it may be true that there are folks who didn't go to college who could do jobs as well as those who did, the point of the realm in our economy for increased wages is certainly a college diploma.
And I thank the caller, Jonathan from Nashville. I'm going to go to more of your calls. I want to go to another email here. Robin writes, if women are indeed having more success in college academics, why do you suppose men still hold more powerful political offices, employment positions, and are making more money? In general, why is it still a male-dominated world if women are doing better academically? Kind of dovetails over what we've just been talking about. If college is indeed the way to success, and women are doing better, and women are continuing to do better, there are still these inequities, and that may be the $64,000 question. But let me go to more of your calls. Alice from Pacifica, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Sure. I didn't catch the comment. One of the researchers said something about experience in a research setting changed women's attitudes toward family and marriage roles, but her voice sort of went out, and I didn't catch what the statement was, nor an explanation of what it meant. So could the researcher clarify that?
Linda Saxon,
maybe I didn't even catch what she said correctly.
Okay, yeah, well, the finding was that participating in research with faculty for undergraduate students related to more progressive views on gender roles among males.
For women. Oh, for men.
For men. But for the women, it led to more traditional beliefs. Now, the why of this is a really good question, and it's something that we need to do further research on. We need to understand the dynamics that occur when men and women interact with faculty in a research setting. You know, what sort of messages are transmitted to female and male students about appropriate roles. It may be that when women gain proximity to faculty by working with them in research, that they either have male role models with whom they have difficulty identifying, or perhaps they have female role models who might be experiencing role conflict themselves. So it's not clear what sort of messages faculty are sending, perhaps, you know, not intentionally, regarding women's social roles.
I'm sorry.
Can I clarify that? I still kind of understand. So actually doing research at the college level for women actually made them want to have children and get married more than before?
It made them believe that was – it led to an increase in their belief that family and childbearing was a more appropriate role for married women. I wish that I had a clear explanation for that. You know, sometimes with all these variables, you find something that doesn't really make sense, and that's what I have here, something that really requires further investigation to understand whether there are certain messages, and what are those messages that students are receiving in a research setting. It's not something that I have data on.
So I hope you got clarity on that, Alice, and thank you for the call. Do we have any data about I also am a college professor and seen a definite increase in the number of women on the faculty. What are the numbers like now? They're still disproportionately outweighed by men, but they've certainly gone up in major way. Jacqueline King, we know?
Yes, we are seeing improvements in women's participation in higher education in faculty roles, but it's going to take a long time because women are coming in as assistant professors and then they have to work their way up through the ranks, and so you still see very large male majorities at the senior full professor levels, and that's going to take a while to change. You also
tenure, you're going to have to wait for a lot of them to die off, I'm afraid, or retire. Yeah.
You also see higher concentrations of women at community colleges than, say, at research universities. So this is also taking a while to move its way sort of through the prestige ladder in higher education.
And here's an email from Jeff, sounding a little bit philosophical. I'll just put this out there. He says, women prefer to concentrate on keeping the boat afloat, and men are preferably moving the boat. Women need to help move the boat more, get us going in the right direction, and men need to humble themselves and help more at keeping the boat afloat. All right. There's your nautical metaphor for the morning. And we'll go to Jennifer. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Hi.
I'm actually a friend of your older daughter's from San Francisco, and both of us went to the University of Michigan, and I just wanted to corroborate one of the researchers earlier, a little bit of fact about how women like to go far away from home in order to have some sort of separation from their family. That happened with me, for sure. I don't know about your daughter, but that happened with
me. Nope, she just liked Michigan.
Sorry?
No, she just liked Michigan.
She just liked Michigan, yeah. Exactly. I really wanted to go far away, and I just became so much more independent, and it was an extremely difficult time for me, but it really just made me into such a stronger person, and I really value that experience.
It's what seems to fall into the category under your research, Linda Sachs, doesn't it? And women are becoming more independent as a result of the college experience, getting stronger internally?
Yeah, it does seem that attending college fulfills a sort of important and perhaps unique role for women in the sense that they need to define themselves outside of a family context and on their own terms. So, you know, being able to sort of separate themselves, it doesn't mean completely separate, but it's about establishing independence. This is increasingly important today as, you know, I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with the term helicopter parents who are sort of hovering over their children throughout all of their elementary, secondary, and then even now higher education. And what we're seeing is that the big question is what sort of impact these hovering parents have on students' development. And the indication from my research is that too close of contact and too close monitoring from the parents can really have a debilitating effect on the children, but in particular for the females.
I was thinking about Black Hawk Down. In some instances, it's necessary to take that helicopter and sort of bring it down. Let me thank Jennifer for her call, and we'll try to get another caller on here. Philip, that's you. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just, as I was listening this morning, I remember just the there seems to be so much information about just the basic differences in men and women from the beginning, like in grade school, all the way through high school. You see boys in a kindergarten, and they're you know, rough housing and not paying attention, and the girls are much more attentive. And it seems like what's happening is the combination that women realize that college is the way to have an independent life. They recognize that, and their genetic tendencies just are fulfilling themselves now.
Well, we're back to nature nurture, and again, that's probably a question for another day. Let me thank the caller. What's going to happen to this report of yours, Jacqueline King? I mean, where does it go from here in terms of any kind of effect on public policy or impact?
Well, our hope is really that it will be useful to colleges and universities and will prompt them to take a closer look at their student populations, at the trends among their students, breaking down the information not just by gender but really also by age, by race, ethnicity, and by income, so that they can pinpoint if they have a female majority on their campus, that so that they can pinpoint where that's coming from, what the impact is on their campus, how that's translating into the achievement of their students and their eventual graduation and participation in graduate school.
And again,
so our hope is for that.
I'm sorry, if you'd be kind enough to give your website again.
Sure, the American Council on Education. The website is www.acenet.edu.
And the report is available and accessible on that website. Sarah Mead, yours again from the education sector?
www.educationsector.org.
And Linda Sachs? Your research, you mentioned, is in a recent journal, but can they get things off the UCLA website? Or
Anybody can contact me. I'm happy to accept email at lsax@ucla.edu. And these findings that I'm talking about today, some of them were in a recent journal of college student development, but I'm in the middle of finalizing a book that will be published in 2007 on this topic.
Well, I look forward to that, and I hope you have the publisher send us a copy. I want to thank you, Linda Sachs, Associate Professor, Graduate School of Education Information Studies at UCLA, Sarah Mead, who is Senior Policy Analyst for Education Sector, and Jacqueline King, Director of the American Council on Education's Center for Policy Analysis. Thanks to our guests. Thanks to you, our listeners. We appreciate very much your being with us. Appreciate also our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., Kevin Guillory, and our engineer, Paul Lancour. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.